Greetings, all you huggable fiends out there. It's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 270. I'm going to be telling stand-up comedy jokes soon in cities like Nashville, Chicago, Indiana. That's not a city. But Bloomington is. I went to an American school. But I'm going to be doing stand-up on the road, so check Nerdist.com/calendar for dates and information on that. Also, the Nerdist channel, YouTube.com/Nerdist, has some great new shows premiering soon. Neil Patrick Harris is Dreaming in Puppets, Neil deGrasse Tyson's Star Talk. So a lot of good Neil action happening over at the Nerdist channel. That sounded weird. Might I extend an extra huge thanks to the sponsor of the Nerdist podcast, it's Stamps.com. Some people say, hey, well, I'll just get a postage meter, and then I'll just print out my postage that way. Well, you are the wizard of wrong, because with a postage meter, you have hidden fees, there's meter ink charges, there's reset fees. With Stamps.com, there's none of that stuff, no long-term contracts, no extra hardware to buy. You're going to save 80% as compared to a postage meter. Plus, you can also do things like use your existing address books. You can send tracking information to recipients with the click of a button. So, guys, the choice is clear. You have to use Stamps.com, and particularly if you want to run a small business, or if you like convenience, or if you want to look cool to your family members, your parents, and your grandmas will be like, how did you get the exact postage printed onto the envelope? And then you'll be like, I'm related to Katharine Hepburn. So use Stamps.com. If you go to Stamps.com right now, you can use the promo code Nerdist for a special offer, no risk trial, $110 bonus offer, and a digital scale, up to $55 of free postage as well. Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com, and enter Nerdist. And now this episode. It was Larry King, and it was such a fantastic chat. It was really cool because I thought I was only going to get like 30 minutes with him. He was like, well, I only have 30 minutes. And then we started talking and we really got into the conversation. And, you know, his producer came in. He was like, Larry, it's 30 minutes. He was like, no, I'll keep talking. And so in a weird sort of way, I almost felt like interview victory. I got him to extend his time. And so that was a weird little achievement unlocked merit badge that popped up on my mental Xbox screen. I mean, this guy has just been on the forefront of media for decades, and I had no idea really how far it went back and the circles that he was involved in. I mean, I knew they would be awesome, but as you find in the podcast, they were very relevant to my interests. And I've never been interviewed by someone who, I mean, he really is kind of a puppet master when he interviews you, because you jump all over the place and then all of a sudden you're just opening up about stuff. I had done his show about a month ago, which is on Hulu.com, which you should check out. It's called Larry King Now. They put up new episodes Monday through Thursday. And I did his show and it was so much fun. I was like, oh, Larry, you got to do my podcast. And then he was like, Chris, stop shaking me. And I let him go and he agreed to do the podcast. So here it is, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 270 with Larry King. Hello, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
I don't have call-in capabilities.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Are we on?
We are.
Okay. That's the way we just...
This isn't like television. There's no official start to this.
Why are we so time conscious then? 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes. If we just angle in, why can't we just angle in and angle out?
Well, because in about 300 episodes, there's sort of an average...
So you could have two guests. Right?
We've actually never had two like stacked guests on top of each other. Actually, it's not a bad idea.
I used to do it all the time.
I know. You've already improved the podcast.
The one thing I've learned in the history of broadcasting, podcasts or whatever, is there are no rules.
Yeah.
Why can't it be four guests?
Yeah. Is that it? But it's interesting to hear you say that, because you've worked in so many different mediums where, you know, radio is very structured and television is very structured.
Yeah, but what I did, the Larry King Show on radio, some nights we'd have one guest, some nights three, some nights four. Some nights we'd have debates, some nights we'd have... In other words, there are no real rules. The only rule I had, which you don't have here, is we had a starting time.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go on, which I had on television, a certain time that I went on.
Right.
And a certain time you went off, and you had a break for commercials.
Right.
But inside the content, it could be anything.
And no F-bombs.
Never cursed.
You can't.
And especially now, do you feel
you cursed on podcasts?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
I see, it's still, that's something about, while I will, in real life, curse, I'll go to a Dodger game and get mad at the ump. But however, it still rubs me wrong in broadcasting. It's probably from the school of broadcasting I came from, which is in the, I grew up listening to broadcasting in the 30s and 40s and 50s. It started in the 50s. I broadcast in 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, seven decades. It rubbed me wrong.
Yeah.
So I never, it just still rubs me. So when I watch HBO and I'll see a movie and the cursing is on,
yeah,
it still hits me the wrong
way. It's just ingrained that way.
Yeah.
I think what's happening with podcasting right now could somewhat be analogous to what you were just describing in terms of, you know, broadcasting in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So do you remember what was the sort of vibe back then, in, you know, like with this radio thing and then all of a sudden this TV thing?
Well, I grew up, I was born in 33, the Depression years, there was no television. I was a product of radio, and radio fascinated me, and it was fascinated me from age 5 on. It's all I ever wanted to do. I was fascinated by voices, still am. I don't think radio will ever be really replaced. You can't have television in cars. Drivers got to listen to something.
Yeah.
And radio is still the theater of the mind. And I was raised in the age of suspense. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Yeah.
Inner Sanctum, The Shadow Knows. And those were hypnotic, incredible days of sitting up by my radio and listening, and then I would listen, I would imitate them. I'd hear an announcer say, you know, Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. That was a daily serial. And I'd run into the bathroom, and I would say, Jack Armstrong. Then when I was in my teens, after school, I'd go into Manhattan. I lived in Brooklyn. And I'd walk by where there was radio stations and pretend I was on the radio there. I'd go right up in the elevator and ride out and pretend I was an announcer. It's all I ever wanted to do. So I was raised in that structure of broadcasting. I wanted to be a professional broadcaster. It's all I ever wanted. When television came, everything that happened to me happened to me. I never sat down and said, my only goal ever was to be a radio announcer. So I never had another goal beyond that. Television came, I've gotten a television. Print, I wrote for the Miami Herald. I wrote daily columns. And then I did national radio show. We did the first national talk show. That just came.
Mm-hmm.
CNN came to me to do it. Whoever thought that I'd be seen, whoever heard of satellites, or that I'd be seen all over the world. So there was nothing planned. It was put out. But I was always a professional broadcaster. I loved the profession. I love everything about communicating. I think it's a great way to make a living. I think it beats work. I never said I went to work. I never used, the last time I worked was when I was 22 years old on a United Parcel truck. I was the assistant driver and would help carry packages into buildings. And then I went down to Miami, got into broadcasting, and I've never worked since.
When did you start, when you started in Miami, how did you break into the
business? Knocked on doors. I never went to college. And I just knew I wanted to do it, and some radio station, small radio station, said, well, let's listen to what you sound like. I'd never spoken in front of a microphone. He handed me a piece of paper, news, and I read that. And he said, well, you sound pretty good. And we're a small station. We have people on the way up or on the way out, if you want to hang around and learn a little bit about what's going on here. First opening, you'll give it to you. So I hung around there for 3 weeks. I was living with my uncle in a little apartment on Miami Beach and hung around this station. And one day, somebody quit. And the general manager came to me on Friday and said, Monday morning, you start, get your own show. You play records, you'll be a disc jockey. You'll do sports, you'll do interviews, you'll do, news. You know, you work all day long, $55 a week. Your show is on from 9 to 12 in the morning, and then in the afternoon, you'll do news. And so, wow. So I stayed up all weekend, picked out my music. I was just so thrilled beyond I was going to be on the radio. It was a small little station. And then the morning I was going to start was May 1st, 1957. You never forget that. It was a warm day in Miami Beach. I got there. I was stayed up all night. Never went to sleep. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. I picked out all my records, and the general manager called me in to his office, and he said, "Well, you start today. Good luck, kid." And I said, "Wow." And he said to me, "This is like 10 to 9. I go on at 9. What name are you going to use?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you can't use Larry Zeiger." My name was Zeiger. And I said, "Why?" He said, "It was too ethnic. People won't know how to spell it." Today, that wouldn't be true. And I said, "What do I do?" And he had the Miami Herald open. And it was an ad for King's Wholesale Liquors on Washington Avenue. And he said, "Why don't you be Larry King?"
Better than Larry Liquors.
So I said, "Yeah, okay, Larry King sounds good." I legally changed it a year later. And then I went in, and something happened that morning, which is why I asked you about structure. I queued up my music. The music is playing. I faded the music. It was Les Elgart swinging down the lane. And nothing came out. I turned the mic on, and I froze. And I turned the music up and turned it down, and I didn't know what to say. I looked at the clock. It must have been like a minute and a half of music playing and nothing coming out. And I was scared to death. And I actually thought to myself that I always wanted to do this, and I'm scared, and I don't have the guts. And the general manager, Marshall Simmons was his name, kicked open the door, and he said, "This is a communications business, damn it, communicate." And he shut the door. I turned on the mic, and I did something that morning that I would do the same today. I told the audience of the circumstance. I said, "Good morning. My name is Larry King." That's the first time I've ever said that. I've just been given that name. "I'm a kid from Brooklyn who always wanted to be in radio. This is my life's dream come true this morning. And ladies and gentlemen, for the past 2 minutes, I've been scared to death. I just don't know what to say, and I've been so nervous. But I figured when the general manager kicked open the door and said, communicate, I better communicate." And I never was nervous again, never doubted myself again, never lost, because I learned something that day, which many people told me later, was I learned the secret of broadcasting, which is, there's no secret. Just be yourself. Later, I was once being interviewed, and the guy said, "Well, what if you were walking down the hall at NBC, and someone grabbed you, sat you down, and said, 'Tom Brokaw, sick, you're on.'" Right?
Yeah.
I would look at the camera and said, "I was walking down the hall. Someone just grabbed me and said, 'Tom Brokaw, sick, I'm on.' Ladies and gentlemen, I've never anchored a newscast before. I'll do the best I can."
Were other people doing that at the time? Because I
I don't know. Arthur Godfrey did it. Great broadcasters did it. They told you of the circumstance they were in. Arthur Godfrey, once there was a commercial for Pepsi-Cola in which the commercial said, "Pepsi-Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot. Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi-Cola is the drink for you."
Wow, that had worked.
Godfrey said, "It's 7 cents everywhere I go. That's a lie. And I don't want to fool you. So Pepsi-Cola, it's still worth 7 cents, but it's not a nickel." I never forgot that. So I never lied to the audience. You can tell the audience the truth. You got a cold? Say you got a cold. Anyways, you sneezed? I just sneezed. It ain't brain surgery.
No, but there was. I feel like there was such an era of broadcasting where they tried to present this sort of rosy, idealized version of life.
Yeah, certain those were the night. I'll tell you an example of that. 98% of broadcasters were, "Good evening. Welcome to another," you know, right? I never did that. And when I won my first Peabody Award, which is Broadcasting's Pulitzer, Alastair Cook was the MC that day. We were at a hotel in New York. You know, about 20 Pulitzer Peabody winners that day. And he said, 99% of the people in broadcasting are imitators. They just try to sound. They try to say the right thing. They try to be somebody else. The other 1% is in this room. So I always felt all I did was be myself. I had no rules. In fact, we had a sign up in the broadcast studio that said, "If in doubt, leave it out." I always broke that rule. I trusted my broadcast instincts. So I never did a show where I said, "Is this going to be a good question? Is this going to work? What do they think of this? I never thought of they. I knew I could communicate. I knew I could elicit answers from people. I knew I could be funny. And I let the show come through me to the audience. They either liked. I couldn't make someone like me. I couldn't strangle you and say, like me. Once I knew that, I can't make you like me. I can't change being me. Why be somebody else? Why paint a picture that's not there? Mm-hmm. Paint the real picture. What do you got to lose?
First of all, it was really awesome for me to get to do your Hulu show.
Thank you.
I had a blast. And my mom, my parents were so excited, and I'm supposed to tell you hi. So hello. But something that I noticed, because on the podcast, we usually talk for a while. It's a very loose conversation. It just sort of goes where it goes. It's very much that idea of like, this is the situation. We're being honest about it. It's very much the guts of that. But what I noticed when you were interviewing me, and I don't know if this is on purpose or not, but this is me overanalyzing. The questions that you asked jumped around so much. I was like, this is how he maintains control of the interview, because I never knew where you were going, and I was just answering. And I guess if I were, you know, a high-ranking official or a political person, you could totally catch someone.
Well, the truth is, the answer to that is I don't know where I'm going either. In other words, all I'm doing is listening to your answer, and then my mind switches to what next curious to me. I'm intensely curious. I'm all over the board. I love learning things. I'm still the same as I was that first day on the air. I still, what, where, when, why. That's what I'm all about. Who, what, where, when, why. The five basic questions.
Yeah.
Who are you? What are you doing? Where are you? Why here? Why is it? And I'm fascinated at the whole learning process. I'm fascinated by the Q&A. I leave myself out of it. I never use the word I. My questions are short, usually one sentence, sometimes two. If it's three sentences, it's too long. If it takes me three sentences to ask a question, then that's why I don't like a lot of what I see today is these guys on the air, they're interviewing themselves.
Yeah.
They're just talking about the guest is a prop. The guest was never a prop to me. The guest is important to me. The reason for the show is why the guest is there. I'm the host. I'll be back tomorrow.
Right. Oh, I violate that stuff all the time. Everything you're saying, I do the exact opposite. I'm doing it now. I feel like because this is more.
Well, it's a different era, and this is this whole. You have to be yourself. If that's your ambiance, if that's this podcast, then you'll go that way. This is more a Mine wasn't a conversation. I'm an interviewer.
Right.
It's not a conversation. Conversation is what we're doing. We're going back and forth. I ask questions. My whole show is Q&A. It's not a conversation. A conversation is, well, I had a meal today, and I ate over at the restaurant, and that's a conversation.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I've never done that.
So you're able to sort of just lightly throw a ball in the air and then just let your guest or guests...
Correct. Focus, let the guest go with it. And what you do in that kind of situation is... If you do that well, you learn by being intensely curious. The first time I interviewed Frank Sinatra, his PR person said to me, listen, I don't know how you got this interview. Jackie Gleason got him for me. And he said, I don't know how you got this because Frank doesn't do interviews. But I'm going to warn you, don't ask about his son's kidnapping because he doesn't want to talk about it. His son was kidnapped, and they recovered it, and they paid a ransom. And so please don't ask about the kidnapping. I said, okay, that's fair. I don't have to ask about it. In the course of the interview, we're now really into each other. I said to him, Frank, with you in the press, have you been bum-wrapped, or has some of it been your fault? And he said, well, maybe some of it was my fault. But I've been bum-wrapped, too. Take the kidnapping. He mentioned it. I never mentioned it. The PR guy, I thought, would faint. And then he told me the whole story of the kidnapping, what happened to him in the press. Why did that happen? Because I made the microphone disappear. I was sincerely interested in him. And I never said kidnapping. So sometimes... Penny Marshall, I just taped her today.
Yeah.
She's written a book. In her life, she's had some bad things happen to her, one of which was she had an abortion.
Okay.
And they told me before we started, she wrote about it, but she doesn't want to discuss it. She had a bad time on one show, and they really hammered it. So she doesn't want to discuss it. I said, even if she wrote about it in a book, she doesn't want to discuss it. So what I asked her was, in your book, you write about an abortion, yet on previous shows you didn't want to discuss it. Why? And we proceeded to discuss it, because she told me what happened on the previous shows. See, I wasn't infringing. I just was curious.
But people feel comfortable with you. I think.
Well, that's the whole secret, but I don't know how I do that. I just know. But that I've had all my life. When I was a kid, I would ask bus drivers why they want to drive a bus. I was a big baseball fan. I'd go to games. I never wanted autographs. I just wanted to ask questions. Why'd you do that? Why'd they bunt? And people felt comfortable with me because they know I have a framed letter from Sinatra at home in which he said, you make the camera disappear. Once you could do that, when you have confidence, when the interview subject has confidence in the interviewer, you go anywhere with them.
Yeah.
You're not a threat. I'm not a threat.
No, and I think that's what most people, particularly, you know, because we live in kind of a headline culture, and it's much more of a headline of someone to be shocked in a situation. And I think most people feel attacked a lot of the time, rather than just, oh, it's okay.
The problem is when an interview gets defensive, you don't learn anything. See, in other words, if someone is guarded and angry, it may sound nice, you know, ooh, son of a bitch. But that may sound nice. However, the audience is not learning anything. They're hearing anger. Well, I'm not there to produce anger. I'm there to learn. And so I take the approach of, why'd you do that? You know, when you ask a question, why, the word why, and sincerely asked, it's very hard not to respond well if you're good at what you do. Like, you know, and no matter what, well, someone said, if you had Osama bin Laden on, would you ask him? And I said, well, the last thing I would ask him immediately would be is, why'd you bomb those buildings?
Right.
See, because then I'm creating defensiveness. Why'd you bomb those buildings?
Right.
That's a dumb question. A good question is, you were part of the royal family of Saudi Arabia. Why did you leave that life? Right now he's going to tell me, assume, why he left that life, why he chose to live in caves. See, then you lead up to bombing of a building.
Sure.
Rather than, why'd you bomb that building? Now that's going to be exciting, and he may be angry, but you're not going to learn why. But if I go that route of why you left the family, see, I'm interested in him. He knows I'm interested in him. Nobody we perceive as evil looks in the mirror and combing their hair says, I'm evil.
Right.
Hitler didn't look in the mirror and say, I am a terrible person. Right. They thought they were right.
Right.
So if you treat them like, why'd you do that? Hitler, what? Why this feeling about the Jews? As opposed to, why do you feel that way about the Jews?
Right.
Same question, asked the right way. So I built confidence in my interview subjects. And this is the way I made a lot of news, and I learned a lot by being, my friend Herbie says, the secret of Larry's success is he's dumb. In other words, I don't know. Help me. All my interviews are basically help me.
I'm a kid from Brooklyn. I just want to know.
I don't. Why'd you do that? Why'd you rob the bank? Why did you kill that person?
Do you think everyone has a sort of inherent need to want to tell their story?
I think so. Maybe not. I don't think there's inherent need to talk about your personal life, but I never knew anyone who didn't want to talk about what they do. I never met an actor who didn't want to talk about acting. They may not want to talk about who they divorced, and that's none of my business.
Yeah.
But I never met a person in any craft who didn't want to discuss the crap, because that's, of course, what they were raised with, what they were built with. That was their goals. So that they want to share that. That you want to share that. So you go with that. Go with they want to share. You know, it's Very few people don't want to talk about themselves. Very few.
Was there one nut in all the years that you just couldn't crack, that you were just like, I'm going to get him this time, and you just couldn't?
Robert Mitchum, who I loved as an actor, just drove me nuts. He just didn't want to be. He didn't want to be there. I think he was, for some reason, and he was all yes, no, maybe, why, what. He just didn't want to respond. So all you could do is all you could do. See, then that goes back to the original. There's no such thing as the perfect interview. There's no such thing as everything. You can't. You just, all you could do is all you could do. You try to learn, you try to weed them out. Sometimes you could take a guess. I didn't with him, but you can take a guess and turn them around. The best example of that is, there's an organization called ACES. ACES are fighter pilots who shot down more than 5 enemy planes in war.
Okay.
And it's a social organization. You call it an ACE. And it was started as America, but now there's ACES all over the world. German ACES, Vietnamese ACES. And they were fighter pilots. It means they're up in a plane alone, taking on other aircraft in the air, shooting at each other. And they have an organization they meet every year, the ACES. And sometimes they find they were in battles against each other, because it's international. Anyway, I'm in Miami, and we find that the ACES are meeting in Miami, and we have an ace, a Miami ace. No kidding. Guy was a stockbroker in Coral Gables, and he shot down 9 German planes in World War II. Going up alone into the sky, shooting at other planes. And he came to be on my radio show. And he was on the last hour, so he was the last guest. And he's on for an hour. He came in, he shook my hand, his hand was sweating. He was so nervous. And the Miami Herald was there taking pictures, and we had this American ace living. And I began by saying, well, why did you get interested in the Air Corps? I liked it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I liked it. Did you take to flying right away? Yes. He was scared to death. I look up, you know, I'm 3 minutes into this, and this guy just don't want to talk. His mouth is dry. He's just, his hands are sweaty. So I switched, and I said, if there were enemy planes overhead now, and we had a plane in the back of the station, would you go pick it up? Yes. You wouldn't be afraid? No. Then I went right to it. Why are you afraid here? And he said, I don't know who's listening. I know who's in the air. I don't know who's listening. So what I did was switch the subject to fear. Why we have fear? What creates fear? And I created a monster. By the end of that show, this guy was doing, we dove for the sky. I saw the whites of their eyes. They were coming. We had to drag them out of the station. Is that it? An hour's up? So I did that by transforming him. And that's working at it. You know, I had to do what I had to do.
How do you remain sort of kind of agnostic to everything? I'm just here with your Hitler or Bin Laden example. How do you keep emotion out of it so that it doesn't kind of get in the way of what you're trying to do?
Because I'm a professional. That's where I start. I started by listening to professional. I'm a professional. I have many opinions. I'm very political. I have opinions on a myriad of things. But I leave it at the door. I leave my ego outside the door. I have a healthy ego. I know I've been successful. I know I'm good at what I do. But when I'm on the air, my role is not what Larry King thinks. It's what the guest thinks. And then I'm a conduit. I ask good questions. The guest, through me, comes to the audience, and the audience makes up their own opinion. And I'm able to do that. I don't like everybody I've interviewed, but I do the best I can to learn the most I can about them. And I learned that by being antagonistic. Like, the only time I can remember, George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama, who was a racist.
Sure.
Later on, he changed in life. But I had him on, and we were getting into the racial issue, and he said something like, he was being a wise ass, and he said, I asked him some question like, what would be the difference, other than pigment, what's the difference between a black and a white? We all have hearts, we all have kidneys. You could take a kidney from another person could be black. What's the difference other than the pigment of skin? What's the difference? And he goes, I don't notice any Negroes at this station. And I said, well, they own the station. They're out to lunch. I just challenged them. And what happened is we got into a verbal argument about race, and I don't think I accomplished very much. And later on years, he came back, and he was different, and he had changed, and I treated him differently and learned a lot more. The racism is the one craw that I've always either gave an opinion about or always annoyed me, because it's the one thing that I grew up with. When I went down south to break into Miami, I got off the train. I grew up in New York, and I saw two faucets, two water-drinking faucets, and one said white, one said Negro, and I drank out of the Negro faucet. And I got on the bus to go to my uncle's house, and I rode in the back of the bus. And I marched in the beaches in Miami when they integrated the beaches, and I never understood it. And I never got a good answer to a question from racists. I still don't get a good answer today. What the hell is the difference? What are you so upset about? Why does it bother you if someone is black or yellow? Why would it matter in your life?
Yeah.
All the money you had spent. Racists spend so much. Look at the South. The South had to build two bathrooms on every floor. Four bathrooms, black women, white women. It's insane.
That's how strong the racism was.
But it's insane.
It is.
The whole thing is insane. Racism. It just so annoys me that I've never understood it, that someone is... that has a feeling about someone just because of their color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense to me. It's just, I'd never heard I'd ask people, I never heard a rational explanation of it.
You can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. A friend of mine made that point. When it's totally true.
Racists are stupid.
There's no real...
If you are a racist, you are dumb.
I don't think we have any racists that listen to the podcast, thankfully.
You never know. By the way, there's a little inner racism because of the way we're raised. You know, Dean Rusk, who was the American Secretary of State years ago, was a Southerner who was very liberal and whose daughter married a black man. And was telling me once that he thought that there's a little bit of racism in everybody because of the way you were raised and what you saw when you grew up. And he thought he was always totally liberal. His daughter married a black man. He had black grandchildren. And he was totally oblivious. He just was comfortable with it. And he got on an airplane once, and the pilot was black, and he was nervous.
Really?
And then he had to grab himself to say, why am I nervous? And he thought was, could the black fly the plane?
Wow.
So he had to measure himself. Even he had that tinge of it.
Well, at least he recognized that.
Correct.
And didn't go with it.
But it was his first thought.
Interesting.
Yeah. We have to examine ourselves all the time.
Well, that's an interesting point, though. Do you feel like you still are examining yourself? Do you feel like, as much experience as you have, that you still go home some days and go, I should have done this, or what can I do to get better?
Oh, yeah. Sure. When you stop learning, you might as well die. I don't know everything.
What are you learning now?
I learn something every day, every time I open up a newspaper. I learn about things in the world. I learn about people. People fascinate me. I every time I go to a baseball game, I learn something I've never learned before. And I thought I knew everything about baseball. I don't know everything. Something you learn every day. It's just people say things to me that I can't. Someone told me once that there are more moves in a chess game, more moves than sand on a beach.
I play chess. I didn't know that.
It's incomprehensible to me. There's no limit to how many chess moves there are.
So why is it then? Because I look at you and I think you're still doing what you do and you're still relevant and you're still good at it. We just had Joan Rivers on the podcast. I feel the same way about Joan.
I just interviewed her last week. I love Joan.
And yet, you know, some people, when they get to a certain point in their lives, they just kind of stop. They just kind of wall off. What is it that keeps you guys hungry and wanting? Because most people don't get older and then go, I want to keep learning. They go, ah, screw everything.
I don't know. There's some people I know like that who I like, you know. In fact, that's more common, to stop learning. They just are what they call set in their ways.
Yeah.
Now, we all are a little bit set in their ways. We're set in our ways. But to me, the whole learning process is so fascinating that to be totally set to say, this is it and that's the way it is self-defeating. It's stupid. It's stupid. Like getting back to prejudice means to prejudge. Mm-hmm. Prejudge is idiotic. I do not like this. How do you know? You haven't tried it. Now, do we all prejudge? Yes. I'll look at certain food and I won't taste it. So I'm idiotic with that regard to that.
That's pretty small in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, correct. But it is, but I still do it.
So was it exciting for you when you leave CNN and then you kind of embark on this new kind of digital frontier of your career? That must be kind of exciting because it's a whole new thing.
Well, I was the first to do the national radio talk show, first to do an international talk show, taking phone calls from around the world. And I guess the internet is new and I'm into the internet. But to me, honestly, it's still 1957 and I'm asking questions. In other words, the transmission is different. Podcasts and internet and digital and satellites. But basically, it's still two people talking.
Those are just accidental qualities.
So the means of transmitting it is different. So instead of picking up the phone at the house, you can walk in the street and have a cell phone and talk on the cell phone. You're still talking on the phone, right? It's still a means of communication. So while I look at it as the transmission is the adventure, but the doing is the same. I'm not doing anything different than I did 55 years ago. I'm being transmitted differently.
Sure.
I'm not doing anything different.
Do you feel like you have that thing in you where you just want or need to work every day?
Yeah, I guess so. I thought I could leave it. I thought I could. But I do speaking. I do comedy shows around the country. I do. I was speaking in Denver on Friday. I speak at conventions. Speaking in Moscow.
You do stand up? Are you doing stand up?
Oh, I do. Oh, yeah. I tell stories. I've told stories all my life. I used to speak at conventions, and I'd be invited to speak at sales meetings, and I would tell funny stories. And my nephew, Scott Zeiger, who's a Broadway producer, very successful Broadway producer. And he said, you leave in CNN, you've done humor all your life. You're really funny. You tell funny stories and you know how to deliver a punchline, you know, timing. Why don't you put those stories together and do an act? And I went on the road and I go on stage, cold, bare stage, the biggest thrill of my life, by the way, it's a bigger thrill than interviewing, is to go out on a cold stage, just you and a microphone. And 2,000 people, they're there because they know you. They don't know what to expect. And you make them laugh. And I love making people laugh. I'll tell you what the comic has. I've interviewed all the great comics, spent a lot of time with comics. If I hadn't gotten into radio, I'd have been a comic. Because you have one of the great moments that a comic has, more than an actor, more than a singer, is they have moments, and that moment is that moment before the punchline.
Here it comes.
When you know what's coming, and you have them, you know you have them because they've laughed already, and it's orgasmic, it's a high, that you're building, you're telling a joke, or you're telling a story, and you know where the story's going, you're weaving this pattern around, or you ad-lib something in it, and you're at that moment, that little moment, that little breath, and then the roar, if you can tell a joke and tell it well, and get the story, and deliver it well, It just is. And when can you make just all comedy is surprise. It's all surprise. Mm-hmm. The ending has to surprise me. That's why I laugh. So I don't know where you're going, and I don't know where this is, and then you hit me, and you deliver it right. And that's why I like comics. You know, I spend so much time with Mel Brooks, Jackie Gleason.
Oh, what was Jackie Gleason like as a person?
Oh, Jackie was a writer. See, now Jackie was not a teller of jokes. Jackie was a comedic actor. Mm-hmm. So he threw into comedy into a scene, like The Honeymooners. He was brilliant. He knew what he was. I was backstage once when The Honeymooners were live. They went down to Miami Beach.
Oh, my God.
In live musicals. And Jackie was a mentor to me. He loved me. He was so good to my career. He did promos for my shows. So I'm standing backstage, and they're on live, coast to coast, CBS. And they're doing a scene. He comes off for a minute, and he says to me, they're in the middle of a scene, and he says to me, hey, right after the show, let's go to Raimondo's. We'll have the Italian guy. It's 30 seconds. He says, we'll go to Raimondo's. Call him up now. Tell him I want the bolognese. 15, Jackie. 10 seconds. Tell him I want the wine. Ready? Tell him we'll be there at 5 seconds. And tell him, Norton. Right? Turn around. Norton. Right in his scene. Right in his cue line. Holy. Holy mackerel. But when you get really funny people, Rickles and I go back. I used to do a show at Pumpernick's Restaurant. That's where I started. Bobby Darin was the first person I ever interviewed that was famous. Lenny Bruce used to come on that show.
Oh, my God.
I'll tell you a scene. Lenny Bruce comes. I got Rickles on the air and Lenny Bruce
together. My God. I can't even imagine.
There's no tape for this. Lenny comes. I can tell we're really into it now. So Lenny comes in a prison uniform. A prison uniform from Rayford Prison and the state prison. I said, Lenny, we're on the radio. I have to tell the radio audience you're in the prison uniform. He says, yeah, a friend of mine smuggled it out and sent it to me. I said, you wear it on the street? Yeah, the hat, the number, the whole thing. Why? He said, I like to go up to cops and ask them directions. And I know what the cop is thinking. Is this an escaped convict asking me directions? Nah, why would an escaped convict ask me directions? However, what about a brilliant escaped convict who would think that I wasn't an escaped convict? Why would I be asking directions? And Rickles said, Lenny, get a job. So those are moments I've had in my life. I've had so many, and I'll incorporate some of this into my stand-up. I'll tell Mel Brooks stories like Mel Brooks' 2,000-Year-Old Man, which is the funniest album ever made. You ever hear it?
Of course.
Okay. I was the first one ever to play that album. Warner Brothers sent it to me. I was a disc jockey in 1959 in Miami. They sent this to me. They heard my work, and I said, play this. I played this. I couldn't believe how funny it was. Carl Reiner's now. I just had breakfast with Carl Reiner last week. And Mel Brooks became one of the funniest men in the world to me, and I loved him, and I had him on my shows many times. Mm-hmm. So I'm at the New York World's Fair in 1964, broadcasting from the Florida Pavilion, and Mel comes on. And I said to him, do you want to play the 2,000-Year-Old Man? He said, sure. So I said to him, well, you're 2,000-year-old. Now, his mind, see, I love the mind. We're at the World's Fair. What do you think of this fair? He goes, fair. I go, wait a minute. Fair? Fair? I said, we got monorails. You said, yeah, yeah, they're nice. Were you at the first fair? I was at the first fair. It was in 0037. 632 people came, the whole world. I said, and you know how they got there? How'd they get to the fair? Well, we had no means of transportation. So the fair was at the bottom, of a ravine. And people would roll into the fair. That was part of the attractions. To watch them roll in, folks, they'd lie down and roll into the fair. I said, well, what? It was 0037. There were no electronics. What was the big hit at the fair? Oh, the Burning Bush. The Burning Bush was big. We thought it was a ride. We jump on and jump off. And I said, well, he says, you know what the number one attraction was? What? Moses. What did he do? He parted the Red Sea. 3 times a day, 4 times on Saturday and Sunday. he was just wild. Then he comes on my show. He was on my show the night we landed on the moon.
Oh, my God.
And that was some night. Oh, my God. We landed on the moon. The whole thing. Now, Mel Brooks. I said, well, Mel, we played a 2,000-year-old man. What do you think of the moon? Landing on the moon. He says, I love the moon. In my whole life, in 2,000 years, I got to say, the moon is my favorite object. I have great feelings for the moon. I love the moon. Why? He said, well, for 400 years, I thought I had a cataract. And a friend of mine, Irving, once said, isn't the moon beautiful tonight? I said, the what? The moon. I would do things with his ear. I could tell. That's the kind of you see. I could deliver a line, right? And I would, Mel, I wouldn't do it a little more. I said to Mel, do you know Christopher Columbus? Oh, crazy Chris. Knew him well. Best dancer in Genoa. The what? Great dancer. With the great. I'm talking before George Rapp. He did the bolero. He did the cha-cha. He did the mambo. He was the number one killer. The best dancer you ever saw. I said, did the queen give him money, Columbus, did he give him money to find the free world? False. She gave him money to take an apartment in Paris because she had a husband whose nose went out and made a left turn. So Chris took the money. I told you he's crazy. He bought ships. Going to find a new world. I said, listen, there's Yuba. Do you remember the day he said the world was round? I'll never forget it. We were sitting around. He walks in with his knickers, this big knickers, crazy. Here comes Crazy Chris. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, the world is round. He said, I laughed so hard I spit on my tuna fish sandwich. I love that. I love comics. I love humor. I love making people laugh. I love telling a joke when the joke works. When you know a joke is funny. And you can make people laugh. I remember I had Gleason and Sinatra together once.
Jeez.
And I made them laugh. I was at a dinner. And I told a polar bear joke.
Which is?
A polar bear goes over to his mother, and says, am I a polar bear? And the mother says, yes, you're a polar bear. We're all polar bears. We're living your cousins. We're all polar bears. Okay. Comes back the next day. Am I a polar bear? I told you yesterday, you're a polar bear. We're all polar bears. This is okay. Comes back the third day. Ma, you got to tell me, am I a polar bear? She says, listen, son, you're driving me nuts. Everybody here is a polar bear. Why are you bugging me? Because I'm freezing. See, now that's funny. If you tell it right way, you space it the right, that's funny. The polar bear joke. It just works.
And you cracked up Jackie Gleason.
Oh, yeah. Frank hit the table, you know. And you know they're going to tell it again, you know. But Gleason, I'll tell you something about it. You appreciate this as a stand-up.
Yeah.
Woody Allen's doing stand-up at The Diplomat. Gleason says, I'd like to go see him. So I go with Jackie Gleason to see Woody Allen. Because you heard about him. And Woody was a very nervous stand-up. He was a writer and an actor, but he was very nervous on stage. He'd wear sneakers, he'd fiddle around, he'd look for the right things to say. It was all part of his shtick. So I told you how Gleason's mind would work. So Woody's telling a story. He said it was October. And I was Woody. And I went hunting. And I saw a moose, and I shot a moose. And I tied the moose to the side of my car, and I drove into the city, and the moose woke up. What do? I got a live moose. And Gleason leans over to me, and he goes, Halloween. That's all he said. And he says, now, Woody then says, it's Halloween, and the Goldbergs are having a costume party. I take the moose up to the costume party, right? The moose mingles. He's drinking pretty good. They have a contest, best costume. The Goldbergs came dressed as a moose. The Goldbergs win the contest. The moose finishes second. They tangle in the middle of the floor. The moose drops down. I grab the moose, take him up to the mountains, shoot him again. It was the Goldbergs. I shot the Goldbergs. And that head of that moose is on the New York Athletic Club, which discriminates against Jews. Little did they know, right? That was it. So now it's after the show, we're going backstage. And I said to Jackie, why'd you say Halloween? And he said, why did he say it was October?
Oh. He's a comedy Sherlock.
That's right. Why did he say it was October? What's the relevance of October? Moose, October, costume.
The idea of you and Jackie Gleason and Woody Allen in the same room is almost melts my brain. Like, those are the kind of stories that a comic wants to hear.
I had that life. I had great times with lots of comics. Hugh Rickles was one of my favorite all-time people.
Such a sweet man. I met him once.
He's the sweetest guy in the world. I have a daughter named Kaya. It's a Jewish name, C-H-A-I-A.
Okay.
When she was born, Rickles called me up and said, is that a kid or a canoe? I seen Rickles do things in clubs. You watch them over the years. He'd have Bob Hope in the audience. Bob Hope is here, big in war. and so the way you do it, and Rickles is so sweet, he wouldn't harm a fly.
Yeah.
And I love, you ever seen his act?
I've never seen him live. No, I've always wanted to.
The Mad Emperor, he walks on with the band playing, he kisses women, and he's crazy. He goes, look, I kid everybody, but let's put it, we're all human beings, and we're all the same in flesh. Jew, Gentile, Black, Asian, Puerto Rican. Well, Puerto Rican.
And he can say anything.
He gets away with it. Oh, he just is. Comics live longer. I believe there's a reason for that. I think if you make people laugh, you have a better life. You have a good life. If in your life, you make people laugh. I've known them all, you know, George Burns. I asked George Burns, God, you're 99 years old. You ever have arthritis? I was the first one to get it.
I know you have to go in a sec.
We did 45 minutes.
We did 45, man. Thank you for sitting here this whole time. I never even... I
do comedy. I do lots of things. I'm a Renaissance man.
What else? Is there anything left that you still want to do?
I think the last thing I'd like to do... I'd like to do a Broadway play. But I wouldn't want to do it for more than like a week.
Yeah.
But I'd like to... I've been in 22 movies, and I've done comedy, and I've done radio, television, read newspaper columns. I've written 16 books. I'd like to be in a play. Probably a Neil Simon comedy.
Okay.
Maybe The Odd Couple.
Who would you be?
Well, it's funny, you know, Felix and Oscar. Interesting you say that, because you're a comic, you'd appreciate this. Jackie Gleason wanted to do The Odd Couple.
The movie?
Yeah. No, just take the stage play. And he thought it was a perfect comedy play. It was just really funny. He loved it. And I said, you're going to play Oscar, of course. He said, oh, no. I'll play Felix. Why? Bigger laughs. See, Oscar, this way Jackie thought, Oscar's a one-note character. He's brazen. But Felix is subtle, mamby-pamby, Mrs. Wife, and he works off it. As Gleason used to work off Carney.
Oh, yeah.
Carney was funny. Gleason worked off him. And if you like working off someone, you could be funnier being Felix. Felix, he says, see, Felix, you can develop. See, Oscar is very well written, but he's one note. Oscar's a slob. Felix is tender. He's lost things. You know,
I feel like an idiot. I never even thought of that. Of course, you think of The Honeymooners as Jackie's show, but he's nothing without Art.
Oh, yeah. He worked off Art. He thought about everything. He let me attend a writer's meeting for The Honeymooners. And they wrote a great script. I'll tell you how sensitive Jackie was. The script was, it was during the Depression. And during the Depression in New York, they would have rent parties. If you couldn't make your rent, you'd throw a party. You'd supply the potato chips and pretzels. People bought wine and liquor. And when they walked in, they drop money in a kitty that you can pay the rent with. It was like a rent party.
Okay.
So he has this whole script, and they write this script, and the Cramdons are having this rent party. Jackie's in, and they're throwing laugh lines. Now Jackie comes in to hear the script. And I'm sitting there, and they read the script for Marvin Marks and this guy. Jackie's laughing. He's pounding. That's funny. That's funny. So we can't use any of it. Why? Cramden would never throw a rent party. Too much pride.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't give the honeymooners a phone. So every gag had to be said. The writers didn't have a phone. You could work a million gags off a phone. People had to come to the door. You never went into the bedroom. Never saw the bedroom in that apartment. I gotta go.
All right, you gotta go. Larry King, this has been amazing.
My pleasure.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, my pleasure. A podcast! I made it, Ma!
You've done
it! Top of the world!
He did it! This was the last thing he wanted to do.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.